Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. .podbean.com.
Happy International Day of Sign Languages. Happy International Day of Sign Languages. And who better to talk about when it comes to sign language in general than the awesomely talented actress who is indeed Tinkerbell. She is Tinkerbell. It's Libby Welsh. How are you, Libby?
Hi. Happy International Sign Language Day to you too. It's a pleasure to be here.
And great to have you. Of course, you might sort of say, hang on, this is a radio interview. How are they actually coping? How can we actually see the sign language on radio? Well, we're working because Libby's an expert at reading lips and so on, and this is wonderful. So share with us the importance of actually having an annual day that marks the importance, obviously, of sign language.
Oh, absolutely. It's actually not been too long since people weren't allowed to speak sign language at all. Sign language wasn't really recognized as an official language in the UK until around 2001. So it's so important to have an annual day to recognize and see and celebrate sign language and sign language users.
So let's move from sign languages to your role as Tinkerbell and this fabulous Peter Pan extravaganza in which you're going to do the whole performance as Tinkerbell every time. Is she alive? Of course she's alive. She has to be alive. Tink, you must be alive.
Oh, you got to believe in the fairies.
Exactly. How is this going to work? And share with us how you got involved with this.
So I am a deaf actress and performer. I'm also a dancer and I'm also an access consultant. So I'm already, self-professed advocate for deaf and hard of hearing people. And it just kind of works out really well because the show is promoting accessible theater. It's what Pantomime Live is doing, what Panto Live is doing is so incredible because it's just so accessible in a way that theater hasn't been before.
And this obviously ties in with Going Live TV, with the Leeds Deaf and Blind Society, with the National Children's Deaf Society and so on. I mean, forget Julia Roberts' incarnation of Tinkerbell in Hook. I can see that people will be saying it's Libby Welsh is setting the standard for this side of things. Were you a fan of the character or is it a case of, look, I'm a jobbing actress, I'll take the work?
Well, it's definitely, there's always an element, you know, when you're an actor that you're definitely jobbing. This is the thing. I was absolutely obsessed with Peter Pan when I was growing up. You know, you say Julia Roberts, I say, Hook, the live action animation Peter Pan. I'm saying Return to Neverland. You know, all of these things. I watched the segment of Art Attack where they made a papier-mâché Neverland. So many times so this is a real sentimental part for me because you know I grew up so heavily invested in Peter Pan.
So was it always Tinkerbell or was Wendy ever in the equation? Did you ever consider the whole notion of sewing Peter's shadow back on, or possibly even Tiger Lily?
Oh well, I always had a deep admiration for Tiger Lily. I also had a deep admiration for Tinkerbell. But I feel like I was Team Tinkerbell for a while. You know, I always had some feelings about Wendy, you know, maybe a little bit of jealousy involved there. But that was mostly because I wanted to run away to Neverland with Peter Pan and not Wendy. yeah, so it's definitely Team Tinkerbell for me all the way.
So, I mean, she can be perceived as being a bit mischievous in her own way. As you're signing the whole performance, how else are you going to just change the interpretation? What can the audience expect from the Libby Welsh incarnation of Tinkerbell?
Oh, trust me, the mischievous, the cheeky, the strong woman role will absolutely be coming through in Tinkerbell, but she will still be, you know, recognizably cute and excitable and very fun. But there will also be recognizable elements of the deaf community coming through as well. if not only because I'm a deaf person myself, where she'll be looking around a lot to make sure she's reading everyone's lips. There will be a lot of, catching up with things at the last moment, being like, oh, I understand what's happening now. You know, lots of things like that, but still being essentially at her core, a fun, cheeky, quirky personality who is just having fun.
And nearly dies, of course.
But, oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I cannot wait for a dramatic, nearly dying scene.
I realise that might be a major spoiler, but, if people aren't familiar with the story of Peter Pan.
I would hope people are familiar with the storyline by this point, yeah.
I still find it borderline shocking between that and the death of Bambi's mother, another sort of major traumatic event. What the hell?
I fully was not allowed to watch Bambi as a child. My sister ruined it for my mother because she was so deeply impacted by Bambi's mother's death that my mum was like, I'm not going through this again. Libby, you're not.
Makes sense. Okay, Libby, we've teased the audience enough. How can people actually access and watch this amazing performance of Libby Welsh's Tinkerbell in Peter Pan?
Oh, well, I know it's still warm. I know it's still September. People necessarily aren't thinking about December and pantomimes, but tickets are available to buy right now. The first performance is going to be on the 14th of December, and it's going to go through until sometime mid-January. And you can go buy tickets, but also more importantly, find out more, see what's going on, how you can interact with the performance outside of the performance itself at www.pantolive.com. It's really cool.
Fantastic. And you're quite right, of course, because it's the thing that most of the country's pantomime theatres are opening up. The press calls are there. This is part of that. It's not just Happy International Sign Language Day. It's important to actually see Tinkerbell in action from that point of view. So pantolive.com, that'll tell folk how to actually book tickets and indeed see your good self in awesome action, which is great. Libby, it's been fabulous welcoming you to the Midweek Drive. Hopefully you've had a reasonably interesting time. And we'll sprinkle that Tinkerbell magic across the whole sort of airwaves. Libby Welsh, take care. And as we said at the start, Happy International Sign Language Day.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So apparently I have a good score, just above average, and with a solid base to build on, according to the uncertainty curious statement that this quiz has revealed. Medium high uncertainty tolerance. Okay, well, I've taken the uncertainty test. What do I actually do now? Well, clearly we need to speak to the geniuses behind the uncertainty test and actually talk about the importance of uncertainty, or not, as the case may be. Make a decision somewhere along the way. And we're delighted, of course, to talk to uncertainty experts, Sam Conniff. Good morning, Sam. How are you?
Good morning, Alex. I'm really well. And congratulations. That's a higher than average score.
Well, yeah, as I say, I thought, what the hey, I'll press those buttons, I'll go through the whole sort of sequence and work on that thing. I might even reserve a seat at Uncertainty Experts for 33% off the ticket price. Who knows?
You will be our guest. And that discount is available to the end of September. So
wow. This is fantastic. And we also have a scientific lead, Catherine Templer-Lewis, with us. How are you, Catherine?
Hello, I'm very well.
Excellent. Sam, can you just talk us through this whole essence of uncertainty? Because it does seem to be one of the reasons for so many stresses in our lives is that things aren't certain. We live in an era where, we hear the Prime Minister talking about the importance of climate. He's never spoken about this before in such passionate terms. What's going on? Is he ill?
Absolutely. I can't speak for Boris Johnson, sadly. But I mean, the definition of uncertainty for me is really the unknown, and the translation of it is a feeling in our bodies. It can be a rushing heart. It can be anxiety in our stomach. It really does connect to everything. There's some research which says the fundamental fear of human beings is in uncertainty. And there's also research that points clearly that uncertainty is the number one driver of all general anxiety disorders. We might not identify it day to day because we're more worried about work or money or our own anxiety or the sleepless nights we've had. But the thing that connects them all is uncertainty. And in the ever more complicated world that we're moving into, being able to manage that underlying causal problem rather than the symptoms of it is going to benefit us all. And this isn't just our philosophy. There's a world uncertainty index. There's manner of report beginning to get their heads around, as Boris Johnson is, the interconnectedness and the complexity that we face. And that's why we've come up with a really simple solution that, as you've already begun to see, can measurably improve people's tolerance to uncertainty and therefore gives them access to the benefits, which can be greater creativity, decision-making, open-mindedness, and much more.
Catherine, there's an old saying which we've used so often, it's almost become a cliche from the Buddhist teachings that where there is choice, there is misery. Now, that could be argued as saying, right, okay, we just need to effectively ensure that people are like sheep and they need to be guided in certain ways. Is it, though, ultimately all about the fear of making the wrong decision or having a perception of wrongness or rightness and actually wanting to be seen on the winning side? Is that at the root of why we tend to be uncertain in many of our decisions and choices?
You know, it's a really good question. It's a really good point. And throughout this series, what we found is we've been weaving in sort of neuroscience with a lot of quite ancient wisdom and looking at the mechanisms behind it. And fear really is the driver of it. We're really, our brains are very afraid. They have a negativity bias. We think bad things are going to happen. But when we talk to our audience, our participants, what was really interesting is that about 90% of them were afraid of failure and failure, you know, and other people seeing them fail when they had choices to make and things to step up to. But when we asked everybody later in the series what their greatest regret they were feared, it was missed opportunity. About 95% of people feared missed opportunity. And so often we're limited by our fear of failure, when actually, if you don't try, then you've kind of failed before you started. And what we're trying to do in the series is interweave these amazing stories of people who have overcome uncertainty themselves with these sort of psychological skill sets that you can learn about recognizing your negativity bias, reframing what's happening in your brain, understanding your stress response, so that rather than going down that route of anxiety, which sort of, you know, in the best case just leads to a glass of wine, but in the worst case really limits you from making choices that really help you, to a place where uncertainty actually becomes your friend and you can use it. Your brain becomes very plastic, as a thing called neuroplasticity, where it can really grow and learn very quickly in uncertainty if you can conquer that fear response.
Past wonderful classic television series have included such titles as The Professionals, The Champions, Secret Agents, and so on. Sam, can you tell us about The Uncertainty Experts, which sounds as though it's going to be equally as exciting and possibly more relevant to people's lives?
More exciting and more relevant, I'd say. The Uncertainty Experts is the world's first interactive documentary, scientifically proven to increase creativity and resilience and decrease the drivers of anxiety. It's a three-part documentary series that you sit and watch and enjoy like any other. But where it's completely different is the stars of the show are people that you've never heard before. Refugees turned CEOs, ex-smugglers turned trauma specialists, people who've been hostages, prisoners of war, or even in prison themselves. And they've all turned their lives around and used the skills of overcoming uncertainty that they learned in the shadows to become leading lights in society. But where it gets really interesting is as they tell their stories and give you relatable and practical techniques for turning uncertainty into opportunity, you get prompts on your mobile phone. And those prompts encourage deep reflection. They've been produced by behavioral psychologists and the world's first empathy designer. And they create a space for reflection and introspection. So what happens is a cumulative effect of both watching the episodes, these very unusual stories, and this interactivity means that by the end of the three-part series, our audience measurably improved their tolerance to uncertainty. And we have a research group against a control group that we were able to measure 6 weeks on. And the increase in their tolerance to uncertainty had gone up 6 weeks after the show.
Catherine, as the scientific lead for this series, I noticed you've got a background in genetic psychology and neuroscience. And I was initially drawn to the notion that does this also begin to address the eternal question of nature versus nurture, insofar as you might well say, well, if you're uncertain, if your parents were uncertain, you're going to be uncertain and so on. You can't actually avoid the uncertainty. Maybe this suggests you can actually adjust it, perhaps.
It really does. And that's a great question. And nature versus nurture is a huge thing. And I think a lot of things that probably parents really worry about as well. But as I tell my mother, it's, you know, it's both her fault. But the hope in it is that it's all redeemable. And yes, we are all often very different in how we approach uncertainty, how anxious we get. And a lot of that is just who we are. A lot of it is our life experience and what we've learned. But in every single case, you can, you know, we use this word neuroplasticity before, you can rewire your brain. You can learn to identify you know, how you, what your tolerance to uncertainty is. And if you go to the website uncertaintyexperts.com, you can actually test your own, as you did, uncertainty. And everybody and everyone in our series can move up that scale. And what's been amazing for me is to see science put into action to actually really help people and prove that we're all actually amazing individuals. We can change the way we think, we can change the way we react, and we can all really become kind of superheroes.
It's a whole new bold step, almost in the footsteps of neuro-linguistic programming. Are there elements of NLP that also echo in this, or is that a completely old school 20th century mechanism that we've moved way beyond?
Well, no, we've actually done something slightly more left field than that. We've been working with an amazing musician called Rosh Godfrey from a band called Mashiba to sort of, I say hack brains, but I mean that in the best possible way. And what we know from neuroscience is that different sounds can actually open the mind up to make it more receptive. It can actually sort of help you explore emotions. So we've created this incredible immersive soundtrack that plays throughout it. And at different points where you need to reflect, we used to play all sorts of things like sounds from nature and frequencies called pink noise, which actually change your brain states and make them more absorbent, more reflective. So we're guiding people's journey with sound, which I suppose is a sort of update really of sort of NLP.
And Sam, from your perspective as creator of the Uncertainty Experts, were there ever any moments where you were uncertain about the uncertainty principle to be applied? Certainly.
I certainly was. Personally, at the beginning of lockdown, my career went off a cliff, and I was one of the unfortunate few who fell between the gaps of furlough and the other support processes. And I have a small family to support, and the pressure became really insurmountable for a while there. I was panicked, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I was looking for guidance, and I couldn't really find it anywhere. And in my background, I'd done a lot of work in the justice system and around entrepreneurship. And I started interviewing and giving space to ex-offenders who'd started businesses. And suddenly I found the kind of wisdom and security and good humor that just wasn't really on offer anywhere else, because obviously the world was trying to get its head around this thing that was happening. But it wasn't really acceptable for our leaders to say, we don't know what to do, yet we're trying to work it out. You know, the interplay that we have with them just doesn't allow for that kind of honesty. And once I'd had this one refreshing interview and got some really good advice and guidance, I became addicted. So then speaking to what I termed the uncertainty experts, people whose daily lives had been thrown upside down, yet they found ways to continue. The refugees I spoke to that are now, you know, doing work around the world, the people who've gone through gender transition, people who've survived depression. And I've got my hands on the kind of advice and guidance that I needed. And I was able to write my own situation, begin a project that had benefits to many others, and is now on its way to hopefully becoming both a kind of new and accessible form of therapy delivered through an entertainment format. So not only are we going to reimagine what therapy can be, but we're also going to reimagine what the entertainment format and documentary can be as well. So yeah, I've lived by the advice from the and insights from the experts in the show, and I'm here as testimony to how life-changing it can be.
We've already mentioned the best place to go to take the immersive experience, which is not too painful. You can score 3, 4, 5, you can go through a Likert scale. It's all wonderful. And then you get a little report at the end of it. Uncertaintyexperts.com. So that's the best way forward. When can people actually expect to see the interactive television series approaching our screens and so on, Sam?
The series is going to be live in November. And unlike most things these days, it's live and there is no recording. You cannot catch up on it. You cannot binge it. It's like when I was young. And if you wanted to watch a show, you had to show up and that was it. So it's got 3 screening times each day, morning, afternoon and night. But once it's done, it's done. There's something to be, you know, that we've been missing about gathering and coming together. And there are benefits to the coming together and sense of community and enjoying something together, even when it is online. So we're sticking to that. So November the 9th, 16th and 23rd will be our chance to come together as a community around uncertainty and move up in our tolerance together.
Well, we have 2 final questions, which hopefully you can answer in the definitive without being too uncertain. But they are customer satisfaction after a fashion. And we'll turn to Catherine first. Catherine, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
A reasonably Zoomer? I don't know. Could you clarify the question?
Nice response. The Zoomer is a word we tend to apply to what used to be telephone interviews, radio features and so on. We now call them Zoomer in deference to the technology. So has it been a reasonably interesting Zoomer for yourself?
It really has been, definitely, because I've just learned that is a new word. That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
Well, there you go.
But, But it also has, because I know scientifically that just me and you talking here today, our oxytocin, the chemical that makes us feel better, will have gone up. Obviously, it would have been better for in real life. But even Zoom calls and telephone calls can actually make you feel better, those moments of connection. So thank you very much for that.
Well, that's number one. Sam, what about yourself? Has it been good for you?
I've enjoyed it very much, Alex. There's been some good and interesting questions trying to unlock this project. It's quite hard often for people to get their heads around the uncertainty experts. There's so many layers of it. But you taking the time and doing the test was really good and felt really nice to hear someone who's taking it seriously. So thank you very much for your appreciation and getting behind the show.
Well, then the next critical question, of course, could lead into another sort of confirmation or not of this. Sam, would you be kind enough to return? Will you come back to speak more of uncertainty with us?
I certainly will. And I'll make an invitation to you, Alex. If I can get your email address, I'll send you an invite for the show so you can come along. And perhaps we can talk about your actual experience of going through it. We can put the full scientific evaluation on you before and after. And let's see what your scores are and talk on the other side.
Well, there we are. I'll confirm that. And Catherine, what about your good self? Will you also return?
Absolutely. I'd love to. I can talk science all day long. And it's lovely to chat to people as you who are so interested in what we're up to.
Catherine Temple-Lewis, scientific lead for the Uncertainty Experts, and indeed Sam Conniff, the creator of the Uncertainty Experts. Be definite, don't be uncertain. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
So actually having a shower, is that the current world version of actually taking a long bath, a long hot soak? Clearly, if we're concerned about the environment, we want to use a shower. It's more effective for the environment than taking a bath and so on. But what is it about showers in particular that make them so positive for us? Well, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous folk to actually talk about a recent survey by Myra Showers to actually talk about this. First of all, functional medical health coach Susie Glasky. How are you, Susie?
I'm great, thank you. How are you doing today, Alex?
Very good indeed, and obviously fresh from the shower, moving into all manner of wonderful things. And we've also got, indeed, from Myra Showers, the MD of Myra Showers. That's the wonderful Craig Baker. How are you, Craig?
Very well, thanks, Alex. Yeah, fresh from a shower as well.
Well, there you go. So, Susie, share with us this particular survey, which suggests that 41% of us have felt anxious during lockdown, 25% are still feeling so, but you can actually enhance your feeling of well-being by simply taking a shower.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head with the word simply, because I think sometimes we tend to think that we go for the big things, like we have to have a day in a spa, or we have to, you know, go to the French Alps, or it's always the big things, or even, oh, I need to go and do an hour's yoga class every day, things that we don't really have time for realistically in our busy schedules. And I think we overlook these what I call micro practices, these very small practices that we can slip into our daily routine without taking much time out of the working day. And for me, I can say personally that my daily shower in the morning is like the cornerstone of my morning routine, my morning self-care routine.
I mean, Craig, when you sort of obviously set up Myra Showers as the MD of the company, were you aware of the medical benefits, other than obviously the hygiene ones and the importance of that, that actually this can also help? It's a bit like a kind of internal version of running around in the rain.
Yeah, well, I wasn't around when we first set up, Alex. That was just about 100 years, actually. So not quite that old, but we've been in this game for a long time, introducing showering to their homes sort of in the 60s. And it was very much around a functional piece of just getting clean. But certainly in recent times, I think amplified through the pandemic as well, this interesting piece of the research that said, yes, it's about getting us clean, but to have that space and that time to think. And quite often, isn't it, people will say, well, I have my best ideas in the shower. And it's just that unique time where the door is shut, everyone is away from you, and you've just got a few moments to think about the day ahead or what you want to be doing in the future.
Susie, I'm particularly interested in the kind of advanced version of the power shower, or indeed the cold shower for 30 seconds. That could be quite a shock to the system. I mean, just talk to us about the efficaciousness of a 30-second cold shower.
Yeah, it's something I force myself to do at the end of the shower, just because the health benefits are really quite impressive and in terms of helping our immune system. And there's lots of research now coming through about the benefits of cold water. That's why one of the reasons I guess so many people are wild swimming in cold lakes in the winter. But it does make you feel great. It really does. If you're brave enough to try it, even if you just manage a few seconds of a cold blast, it's incredibly invigorating. And I think you kind of feel strong, you know, and mentally strong as well as you know, physically enhancing our immune system and all the rest of it.
Craig, you mentioned that the shower has been with us for over 100 years and so on. Do you feel that actually the bath, we're never going to get back to that. The bath is yesterday's news. Forget that. It's the shower all the way.
You know, as I'd obviously, as the MD of a shower business, would probably say yes, absolutely. But the reality is, you know, the bath definitely has its place. But we've been moving away from bathing for some time now. Yes, originally from sustainability reasons. But now I think what we're able to do with the technologies in showering is really build on this experience. You go in and come out of a shower in a slightly different mindset and frame to think about. And that's because we can start personalizing these experiences. So as Susie just said there, you know, that freezing cold shower finish could be something that energizes you, but it's certainly not for me. I don't know about you. So that ability to personalize and the type of spray, so whether you're coming in from a gym or whether you're getting up first thing in the morning or just about to go to sleep at night, that's where there's some real opportunity for a shower to offer something different, something quite bespoke to you rather than sitting in a bathtub.
Susie, Craig mentioned the importance of mindfulness there. Is that also a valid aspect of the shower experience from the point of view of experience of the toweling afterwards, the experience in the shower? Does that also help and assist with the whole process?
I really think it does. I think if we can be present in the shower and actually take a few minutes just to feel the water on our skin, to smell the soap, the shower gel, whatever we, and to enjoy the physical touch, because it's not just touch from other people that enhances our well-being. It's also self-touch. So just the process of while you're washing your hair, can you give yourself a little head massage? You know, and all of these things are incredibly calming for the nervous system and are going to give us that boost to our emotional resilience before we face whatever it is that the world is going to throw at us today.
And is there an optimal number of times you should shower a day? Is it twice? I mean, we hear Dwayne Johnson goes for 3 showers a day. Is there such a thing as too much showering?
Craig, do you want to answer that?
Well, I'm not sure I'm an expert with Dwayne Johnson. He does seem to like the shower, doesn't he? And I guess as a big guy that enjoys wrestling, I can imagine that 3 times a day is what he needs. But I think to the point, Alex, it's really a very personal choice. I think some people enjoy a shower first thing in the morning just to get themselves revved up, ready for the day. Some like it to help them sleep at night. I personally like showering twice a day. I fall back on that point that it's more than just getting yourself clean. It is definitely about setting your mental state. But I think what we're doing a lot here in terms of technology is allowing people to shower, if you wanted to shower more frequently, is working on that sustainability piece. So we're introducing things like air into the water, so the water feels heavier and more powerful, which is what we know through the research people like. But it also means that you're not draining your tank particularly quickly. And so you should feel perfectly okay and not a social conscience in terms of showering too much.
I'm glad you mentioned the sustainability alarm, because that is obviously another system in terms of we're often told you need to be quite spartan with your showers because you don't want to use up all the water, which is very important. Where can people go to find out more details about the survey and indeed Myra Showers, Craig?
The easiest way to do that is just to come along to our website, which is simply myrashowers.co.uk. And on there, you'll find all sorts of information about our history, but also about the latest technologies and the perfect showering experience for you.
Excellent. It's been a cleansing experience in a mindful sense. I feel as though we've had a shower of questions, which have kind of brought sprinklings of delight through all of us today. So to Craig Baker, Managing Director at Myra Showers, and of course to Susie Glaske, Functional Medicine Health Coach Extraordinaire, huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Alex.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Recent research by Vision Express has suggested that the awareness that women have of the way that menopause can impact their eyesight is somewhat low. In fact, 67% of women also feel that media portrayal of menopause brands them a walking hot flush. Totally unacceptable. Half, of course, are not aware of the effect menopause can have on their eye health. And accordingly, we are pleased to actually address this issue and invite you to actually share with us some of the kind of findings of this particular study from Indeed Vision Express, the wonderful optometrist, Pina Govind. How are you, Pina?
Very well, thank you. Alex, thank you for having us.
Excellent. So, Peter, talk us through some of the findings of this particular survey in particular, and indeed the impact that menopause can indeed have on eyesight.
Yeah, so as you just described, you know, we were surprised to learn that over half of the women that we'd spoken to weren't actually aware that some of the ocular symptoms or the eyesight deterioration that they may have been experiencing was actually attributable to the menopause or may have had a link to the menopause. And of that population of women that we spoke to, you know, over a quarter of them were then not feeling that they were comfortable enough to actually seek help or speak about some of their symptoms, which is a worry and also something that actually a lot of optometrists will be able to help with some relatively straightforward and simple solutions that women can try at home to alleviate some of the symptoms that they may be experiencing. And just improve the overall quality of their vision, but also their ocular comfort as well.
And that, of course, is critical to this particular piece. So it's interesting that despite a deterioration in eyesight, we had 14% of women who hadn't had their eyes tested in over 3 years. I mean, regular eye tests are surely a part of everybody's general well-being and probably need to be borne in mind across the base, really. And we also welcome to the programme at this moment in time, indeed, Eleanor Mills. Eleanor, good to see you. You've got your camera on, so I switched my camera on as well, which is great.
Hi.
Eleanor, we've just been speaking with Pina there about, obviously, this particular finding. Were you shocked at all by this relationship between, obviously, the unawareness of the menopause and its impact on eye health?
I think that there's such a huge lack of information just generally about the menopause that I'm not at all surprised that nearly half of women have no idea that their eyesight is going to be affected. I think that lots of women just don't understand all the different kinds of changes which are hitting their bodies during menopause. And eyes, of course, are affected by lowering rates of estrogen or the fluctuating rates of estrogen, because estrogen acts as a lubricant throughout the body. So it's also why we get brain fog and stiff joints and all of those kinds of things. And I think that most women don't understand how all those things are linked together. And often then when they go to their doctors, they're not really much the wiser, because many doctors don't take a particularly holistic look at how all those symptoms join up. So I really welcome this new conversation around the menopause. And I think eye health is such an important part of that, because it's really, I've written an article, which is going to be in the papers next week, which is about, I went to a restaurant for a special night out with my husband, and we were all excited. And the menu was so small, the writing on the menu was so small, and it was so dark. Neither of us had brought our glasses because we were out for a jolly dinner. And we could not read the menu. It was actually turned what should have been a really fun evening into a bit of a chore. It was a bit of a chore. We ended up ordering something which has meat in it, when my husband's a vegetarian, all that kind of thing, which sounds small, but actually all those frustrations, and that really is reflected in the survey, really mount up. And the other interesting figure I thought was that 80% of women say that sense when their eyes start to go in middle age is the first time they really start to feel old. And that evening in that swanky restaurant, I suddenly felt a bit like Miss Marple, kind of without my glasses. I kind of really couldn't see the world. So it's also that sense of a changing perspective on yourself.
You could never be old, Eleanor. We could define you as experientially enhanced or possibly chronologically gifted, but you're never going to use the O word. It's not going to happen. It's clear.
No, I don't. I definitely don't believe in old. And I think the amazing thing about midlife is one doesn't feel old. What we need is the information so that we can go on feeling well. And going and having an eye test is part of that. Going and having a mammogram, keeping yourself in, you know, fine fettle so that you can enjoy the next phase of your life. In the 100-year life, which many of us are looking at now, 50 is only halfway through. And that was why I called my platform Noon, because it's only halfway through the day. And as we say, there's so much more to come. And getting the right information around menopause, around your eyesight, around your health, your nutrition, exercise is part of empowering women to live their best lives in midlife. And I think it's important to encourage them to do that and to see themselves differently as a result.
That's clearly why you are probably the best editor the Sunday Times ever had. But there we are. That's part and parcel of the whole sort of sequence there. Let's move back to Pina. I mean, Ellen has been sharing very passionately there, obviously, some of the key areas of the growth process, the development process, etc. We've talked, Pina, about the importance of getting regular eye tests. Would you endorse everything that Ella's been saying? And obviously that this is one of that whole smorgasbord of activities that we can ensure we're engaging with. And certainly when it comes to vision, to ensure that we don't go to a restaurant and start ordering meatballs when we're actually vegan or vegetarian or whatever.
Yes, absolutely. I think as women, many of us are very busy juggling lots of different activities, whether that be work, family, etc., and often don't prioritise our own health and well-being. And, you know, there's so many symptoms associated with menopause, and the ocular symptoms and the eyesight deterioration is just one of many. And I think a lot of women perhaps just put it down to, oh, it's one of those things with menopause, I've just got to learn to live with it. By keeping up with these regular checks, the eye checks in particular, we can help to maybe just alleviate and give some simple solutions to help make life a little bit more comfortable and just a little bit easier, so you don't necessarily have to then just put up with all of these symptoms.
Yeah, I would go further than that. I think it's important not to put up with them and to embrace all the different things that we can do and the information and the ways we can make ourselves feel better so that we can enjoy this next chapter. For many women who've been, you know, working all their lives, raising children, looking after elderly parents, and there's all these things that hit in midlife, you finally get a bit of a breather sometimes in your 50s where you go, well, actually, maybe I don't have that many years left. What do I really want to do? How do I make these last decades really count? And that's what I really see in my community of midlife women, that there are so many women going, This is time for me. This is the time when I can actually go and revisit those dreams I had when I was younger. I did an interview earlier this morning, and the DJ was telling me that she has just started writing a thriller, and she'd also set up her own radio station and things like that. Loads of women like me, I've just founded my own business at 50, and there's a lot of life in us yet, and yet too often the narrative around us is that we're at the end, you know, we're at the end of our days, we become invisible. And it's just not true of the women that I see around me. So that's also about changing the lens on midlife. But to do that, we need the information and the health advice so that we can keep ourselves in good shape and go on and do all the things we want to do.
As I said, Eleanor, that's one of the reasons we can never use the O word in a description of your good self. It's absolutely critical in terms of that basis. Where can people go to find out further details about the Vision Express survey and indeed more information about what we've been discussing today?
Yeah, we've got a lot of information available on the Vision Express website. So, you know, have a log on, have a look at what's going on. And if you'd like some further advice face to face, then do, you know, pop into one of our stores. You can speak to some of our eye care professionals or even give us a call, and we'd be more than happy to give you some advice like that.
Fantastic. And Eleanor, yeah, how can people also access your own fabulous online material?
So we've got lots of stuff because we've been doing this campaign with Vision Express, and we've got all these other women in midlife who are seeing themselves differently, who we've had photographed by the fabulous Amelia Truebridge. So these are real life women who are really entering this next chapter and feeling great about themselves. So that's all on my platform, which is called Noon, as in the middle of the day, noon.org.uk. And there's lots of information there about the Vision Express partnership as well. And we've also got some incredible pictures of Joe Wiley, who's heading up this campaign for Vision Express, and for me, all about how she feels about midlife and about her own kind of glasses wearing and all that kind of thing. And that's all on our new Instagram as well, which is called The Pod Noon. You can check out what we're doing there.
Absolutely wonderful. I mean, Noon, interesting enough, was that cite as a title because it's literally the middle of one's life? Is it a case of a tribute to the Gary Cooper Western High Noon? Is it something else? Is it an acronym for nice, orientally oriented sort of?
No, it's not an acronym. It's because it's at 50, we reckon we're in the middle of our lives. And it's called Noon because it's the middle of the day. We've still got the afternoon and the evening to come, which, as we know, are always the fun bits. And we think that people should be seeing this as an age of opportunity. We want a new lens on midlife for women to see themselves differently and what they're capable of at this point, which is why we've been so excited about working with Vision Express on this. And I think it's a really important message, not just for older women, but actually for all women, to look forward to this point in their 50s where they have an opportunity to start a next chapter, to live their own dreams, and for, and not to feel that society is kind of wiping them out, making them invisible, ignoring them when they hit that point, which has for too long been the case. And as a scion of the mainstream media, I definitely saw that happening. It's why I felt so passionately about setting up this whole platform to help women live their best lives at this point.
Eleanor, don't get me started as being male, pale and stale, because that's a different line entirely, but that's another debate for another discussion. For the moment, award-winning...
We need all the allies we can get. We'll be happily happy on noon.
Eleanor Mills, award-winning journalist extraordinaire, of course, and ace optometrist Pina Govind, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and enjoy the afternoon.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thanks.
Well, I've often said it's the chihuahuas you have to watch out for, and then maybe the tiny poodles or maybe it's other small dogs. It would seem that when it comes to antisocial behaviour, it's the smaller dogs that tend to be the worst when it becomes, if you use worst, meaning unruly, certainly compared to large dogs. However, it also would seem that many dog owners are using the wrong kind of behaviour to keep their canine friends in order. Certainly the whole notion of dragging the dog away, indeed actually shouting at other dogs, don't do it. And somebody will be able to tell us why you shouldn't do those activities and how best to actually avoid antisocial dog behaviour in the first place is, of course, the ace dog trainer and behaviour expert, the wonderful Carolyn Menteith. How are you, Carolyn?
I'm fine. I was laughing at your description of attack chihuahuas.
Maybe it's just a bad experience I've had, really. But sometimes you just think, look, enough already. Give me a nice sheepdog or a Labrador or something any day of the week. But that's by the by.
Well, it's actually quite interesting because the survey that was done by Tails.com has shown that the group that most people thought were problematic when it came to antisocial encounters were small dogs, which is probably not what people expected. They probably thought it was all the bigger dogs, the butch dogs, the bull breed type dogs, and it is actually the small dogs. And I think one of the things that people quite often forget is that aggression for dogs is a last choice behavior. And all aggression does for dogs is make bad stuff stop or make bad stuff go away. In other words, it's what dogs do when they're feeling worried, frightened, scared, or that their owner is just not going to help them get out of this difficult situation. And obviously, if you are a tiny dog, there's more things that are going to scare you in the world, and there's more things that are going to make you feel worried. And so we always have to be looking out for our dogs, thinking, how are you feeling right now? And how can I make you feel better? Because when you feel better, then you don't have to do the antisocial barking, growling that comes from feeling worried, frightened, or insecure.
The top three actions that dog owners said they would actually take, as we mentioned, 82% saying they grab their dog to remove them from the situation. 49%, just under half, said they'd shout or make loud noises to scare the other dog. And most unfortunate of all, 8% actually said they'd hit the other dog. No, I would have thought. Just don't go there.
Well, no. I mean, there's so many things. Where do I start with all of that? One of the things that we forget about dogs is we don't talk dog. Dogs are very, very good at getting themselves out of difficult social situations most of the time. And where it quite often goes badly wrong is when we interfere. And sometimes our interference can be just as simple as the fact our dogs are on the lead. And so they can't approach each other in a natural way. If you watch dogs interacting, they'll circle around each other. They'll never come directly face to face. They'll approach and they'll retreat. And when we've got dogs in the lead, first of all, they're already not able to communicate properly. And then if they are feeling a little bit worried, if we start flapping our arms around and hitting and shouting, all we're going to do is take a situation that might already be just, you know, tiny little bit tense and turning it into something that becomes far, far more serious. What we should be doing with our dogs is avoiding encounters with strange dogs that they don't know, especially when they're on lead. Avoidance, education, prevention, that's the only way to get out of these aggressive encounters. It's like kind of saying, how do I get out of a car crash when it's happened? You don't. You get out of it by being aware, by avoiding difficult situations, and being as educated as possible.
prevention being the best solution to diffusing a potential situation as well, presumably. I always remember the instruction that I was given whenever one was around horses to actually avoid the hind end of horses and to actually ensure that you keep them in eye contact for the majority of the time as well. For people who are concerned about dogs as well, and some people do have a phobia of canine friends and such like, and they get concerned, what advice would you actually give to prevent any other accidents occurring from the point of view of dogs feeling threatened by the animal of the two-legged variety?
Well, following lockdown, the first lockdown, we now have 3.5 million more dogs in the UK than we did 20 months ago, which does mean that almost anywhere you go, there's a third of households have dogs. We're going to come into contact with dogs, whether we're dog lovers or whether we're really, really worried about dogs, we're going to come into contact with dogs. And one of the things that we have done with Tails.com on the back of this survey that we've done is that we've put together an education pack on the website in blogs that helps people be able to understand dog body language, know how to control their own dog and what their responsibilities are, because all dogs, we've said tiny dogs, all dogs can be dangerous because they've got teeth, they've got claws, and it's up to owners to make sure that they don't let their dog become a canine hooligan that everybody crosses the road to avoid. So we've put together quite a comprehensive education package to try and prevent accidents happening, no matter who you are, whether you're a dog owner, whether you are a member of the public, whether you're a parent with children. And also, most people don't want their dog to be a problem. They don't want their dog to be a canine hooligan. They just don't know who to approach, how to avoid it, because they've missed out on all those puppy classes, training classes that have always been a part of dog ownership up until lockdown.
Is it an urban myth that ultimately owners start to look like their dogs and vice versa?
I have judged the dogs that look most like their owner competition. I maintain that if you put six people in a room and brought their dogs in and I didn't know who belonged to whom, I'm pretty sure I could match them up. I'm not too sure whether owners start to look like their dogs or whether we choose dogs who are the antithesis of what we think we are. I'm not entirely sure, but there is no doubt that you can match dogs and owners 95% of the time.
Yeah, extraordinary. Carolyn, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with yourself. Where can people go to find out more information? Would it be tails.com?
It is tails.com, and within the website there's a blog section, and within that you will find everything linking to this survey and all the help and education that we can give to help prevent people get into problems with other people's dogs, or even how to not get into problems with their own dog.
And I've already cited my preference for the Border Collie or the Labrador. Do you have a particular favourite breed, or is that something you couldn't possibly answer, Carolyn?
I couldn't possibly answer. One of the things, I learn something from every single dog that I work with. Border Collies I completely love, but then I don't want a dog who's got more brains than me, so I don't plan to own one. I love all dogs. I love all dogs. One of the things that I think is really important for all owners to think about is to look at the job that dog was originally bred to do, because that's going to tell you what they're going to be like to live with and what they're going to be like to interact with. So if you want a dog that you want to be able to throw balls with and they'll retrieve for ages, don't get a beagle or a pug. Get a dog that's going to suit your lifestyle. So that's very much where I am when it comes to favourite dogs. I look at what my lifestyle is at the time and what dog would want me more than what dog I would want.
Carolyn Menteith, dog trainer and behaviour expert extraordinaire. Huge thanks, and may your canine friends continue to appreciate your wonderment.
Thank you.
So how would you do it? How would you react if you actually won £1 million, or if you received that telephone call to actually say you've won a large sum of money? We can obviously see and hear how some folk have actually reacted to the whole process. But the National Lottery has actually revealed some of its most goosebump-worthy winning moments as players actually found out that they'd won, quite literally, an extraordinary prize. And to talk us through some of the findings behind this, we're delighted to welcome somebody who pretty much seems as though he wins the lottery every day because he's Senior Winners Advisor at Camelot. It's Andy Carter. How are you, Andy?
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. So, Andy, presumably you are in many ways rather like the day-by-day, week-by-week Santa Claus who gets the opportunity to advise people how to react when suddenly they've been told they don't owe £100,000, they've won £100,000.
That's a really nice way of putting it. Yes, it's a strange job. It's a real privilege, actually, because you get taken into people's lives at a time that they will never, ever forget. So, yes, I'm part of a team of eight people. And when someone wins more than £50,000 on a National Lottery game, we go out and pay them their prize. I mean, I would say there's a bit more to it than just giving the money over. I mean, really, I think probably we add more value in our job around making sure people have access to good support and good follow-up advice and aftercare. Because actually what they're going through is an absolutely life-changing, mind-boggling experience.
And you're absolutely right to allude to that, because clearly there are lots of cases, lots of tales, lots of stories and narratives that you don't have to look too far to find out that people have actually found that, you know, winning a large sum of money, whilst apparently seeming to be the solution to all their challenges, was simply the beginning of a whole series of different challenges and concerns within that. So a decent support structure and a network of ensuring that the whole process is managed effectively presumably is essential to the individual's well-being.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the National Lottery has been going 27 years now, and in that time, it's been over 6,000 lottery millionaires. So, and really now more than ever, we've got a better support structure or a more in-depth support structure than ever before. So, not only do people get access to legal advice and financial advice, we also make sure they have access to a life coach who can talk to them about going through change and coping with the emotions of change. They have access to other lottery winners, because actually, you know, if you've won £1 million on the National Lottery, the best thing you can do is go and have a cup of tea with another winner, because they're the only people that will truly understand.
And what reactions have you actually seen, Andy, when the good news has actually been delivered and, as you say, a life-changing sum of money has been passed on to somebody, or at least you've said, by the way, you've just won £500,000 or whatever?
Oh, well, I've seen lots over the years, from jumping up and down and, you know, a party going on by the time I arrive. I've seen people faint. I've seen people be sick with excitement. I've seen people dumbstruck. I've seen people resign on the spot. I've seen people, the most powerful ones, when you see somebody telling one of their family members they've won, because I've been in people's homes and I don't know, someone's brother or sister or son or daughter has come in to the house not expecting me to be there, and you've seen it when that person has had to turn to their daughter and say, this guy's here because I've won £1 million, and then you'll see the reaction on their face because it's the first time they've heard the news. That's really powerful, because that's you being let into sort of quite an intimate family moment at that time. But I think really you could pick up the emotion from the calls, really, to be honest with you as well, because people are just dumbstruck. It's such an unusual thing to happen.
Again, I was looking towards that. Have there ever been moments where people actually feel as though it is a hoax, it is a prank, they go silent, they actually put the phone down on you? Are there ever sort of moments where you're trying to actually let somebody know that they've won this major prize and they just refuse to accept it?
You get the odd moment where I think sometimes people are a bit cautious because they think there's, you know, some sort of scam going on. But I mean, we have a lot of systems in place where we can refer them back to sort of to prove that they know who they're speaking to. People are more in disbelief, you know, and sometimes it's always the dad of the family that's the prankster, isn't it? If the dad's a bit of a joke and he's set the wife up before, the mum up before, that tends to come through. But no, you soon get through that.
So what do you usually advise, Andy, to people who've actually won the National Lottery? What is it, a case of, well, as you said, sit down, have a cup of tea, or indeed, if you don't like tea, just have a glass of water?
Sit down, do nothing quickly. That's the first thing to do, definitely. Let it all sink in, because listen, you might win the National Lottery again, and we've had double winners, but you know, even the chances are this is a once in a lifetime moment. So make sure you savor it, because you don't want to look back on this time and think, well, I didn't actually take it all in. I didn't savor it enough. So certainly savor it. So take time, do nothing quickly, write a list, take good advice, you know, because actually the thing is with winning the lottery is we find people who won the lottery, everyone around them is an expert on winning the lottery then. Whereas actually lottery winners themselves need experts who are used to dealing with other lottery winners, whether that's a lawyer or a financial expert or a life coach or a counsellor, whatever. They need to have expertise in that area because it's quite unique. You know, you've come into quite a shock. And okay, there's been 6,000 lottery millionaires, but it's not something you can sort of say, well, ask my friend how they felt when they won the lottery, because the chances are you probably don't know someone who's won it before. So our job is to really build up a support structure and also give them a network. There's a whole network, a community of lottery winners who are there to help each other out too.
So presumably in terms of making sensible decisions, no matter how tempting it might well be, if you win, say, £500,000, to say, oh, that means I can actually buy Ronaldo for at least 2 weeks of his work and time. That's not going to work, is it, really?
Yeah. A bit of Ronaldo. It's interesting that we would say to people to make sure, particularly with the financial planning side of things as well, we make sure they have access to a financial planner who can sit down and show them how the future can pan out if you insist on buying the big house straight away, or you insist on going on 10 holidays a year or 12 holidays a year. They can sort of demonstrate that, and then people can make really good choices.
And I was just going to say, it was interesting in terms of the top 15 things that people would do if they found they'd won the national lottery. Kissing their partner is number one, which goes just ahead of jumping up and down, screaming, bursting into tears, starting working out who to give the money to. And at number six, actually, call their mother. Marvellous.
Yes, I think that's heartwarming, because actually, and I know everyone doesn't have access to their mum, but actually you do want your mum at a life-changing moment. And we quite often find winners, if their parents have passed away, still think and talk a lot about them when they've won. It seems to be a sort of needing. Everyone needs their mum or their dad, don't they, at these sort of times, however old you are. So yes, that was quite heartwarming, I thought.
Yeah, very much so. So Andy, how can people actually find out more about what we've been talking about, or indeed if they're looking to actually win big and soon? Is it simply a case of, well, buy a ticket? You have to buy a ticket, otherwise you won't win it.
Yeah, you have to buy a ticket. I mean, there's a huge draw on Friday night, £111 million. EuroMillions draw on Friday night. If someone in the UK wins that, they'd be inside the top 10 British winners ever. That's a huge amount of money. And obviously, you can buy tickets from local retailers or on the National Lottery website, national-lottery.co.uk. And also the calls that we talked about are available to listen to there as well.
Fantastic. So Andy Carter, Senior Winners Advisor at, of course, Camelot. Long may you continue your happy work. I can't believe it's 27 years, Andy. I mean, I still remember when people had life-changing sums of money via doing the football pools. That's all gone. That's so 20th century these days.
Well, yeah, I mean, 27 years, I think we can sort of safely say the lottery has been a success those 27 years, raising £30 million every single week. You'll see a lot of change in British society as a result of that. So I think it's something that everyone in the UK can be proud of.
And I've got to ask the question, Andy, do you play yourself at all?
No, I'm not allowed to play. People in our homes, so my wife can't play. It doesn't stop me thinking when I go and see someone, what would I do if I won that amount? Of course I play that game in my head. But no, I'm not allowed to buy a ticket, and nor are people in our homes. So this is the next best thing.
There you go. Delivering good news as opposed to receiving it. It's often said it's better to give than to receive. So you're clearly manifesting that one, Andy. Huge thanks, Andy Carter, Senior Winners Advisor at Camelot. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.